This episode is brought to you by BundleRabbit.com, Earth's most accessible book bundling marketplace. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of 24 books, 34 short stories, and countless articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this quest to raise your output to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 298. Today, Nicole says, emotion in writing helps draw in the reader. Do you have any tips and tricks on how to learn more about expressing emotion in writing? I have borderline personality disorder, and in my life, moods are like a roller coaster bouncing to extremes, and I would like to learn how normal people deal with emotion. Well, Nicole, this has a lot to do with the mechanics of borderline personality disorder. And since one of the episodes in the Deep Characterization series that I've got planned has to do with how abnormal psychology affects other aspects of characterization, those of you in the Peanut Gallery listening to this might want to bookmark this episode and re-listen to it later next to the other episode, because I'm going to try to tackle this in as much depth as I can without going too long. Borderline personality, for those of you who either don't have it or haven't studied it, is an emotional triaging disorder. It shares a few qualities in common with psychopathy while being completely different in terms of the neurological nature of its functioning, that sort of thing. The thing they share in common is that both psychopaths and borderlines have trouble touching reality in different ways. With a psychopath, it's because they tend to have attenuated hot empathy response. Hot empathy is the kind of empathy where you look at someone who's crying and you immediately feel sad. Or you look at someone who's hurting or you see someone get their finger cut and you immediately wince. And it's this automatic response where your sensory apparatus connects directly to your amygdala way before it passes through any of the other processing centers of your brain. Psychopaths have an attenuated response in that sense. Because of that, other people's emotions don't feel quite real to them, and other people feel less real to them the further you get up the psychopathy spectrum until you get way over the top end where the other people don't feel real at all instead of just feeling distant or alien. Borderline personality has a different kind of problem with triaging emotions. With borderlines, the emotions of the moment feel like a deep connection with fundamental reality. And as you can imagine, that makes life a living hell. It makes it very difficult for the borderline to navigate because they have difficulty distinguishing between something that's just an intense passing emotion and something that's a deep truth of the universe. And because of this, it flattens. If you've ever gone like 2 days without sleep, and you get to that point where everything in the world feels flat because you don't have the energy and you don't have the filtering ability to tell this is important and this is not. So at the same time, you're liable to discount really important things because you're just too tired to deal with them, and yet you're willing to go ballistic over the fact that someone's playing their radio too loud, or you're prone to misinterpret a gesture from a loved one as being aggressive and mean when it was just thoughtless or didn't have anything to do with you. There's a similar quality in that to what borderlines experience every day. Not because the emotional response is dulled, but because the emotional response is flattened. And I mean flattened in an audio engineer's sense. Flat doesn't mean low. It means everything seems to be of equal importance. In the case of a borderline, everything is turned up to 11. And so it's hard for them to distinguish. I think I mentioned that this makes life for borderlines kind of a living hell. It also makes living with them very, very difficult. And as a result, they tend to have very intense, very short-term relationships because they gravitate towards people based on the feelings of the moment. And those feelings are not necessarily the most accurate way to assess compatibility in romantic relationships or business partnerships or close friendships or anything like that. But because of the flattened emotional response, they gravitate towards the extra intense feelings, which puts them on this incredible roller coaster, and it also makes them feel antsy anytime there isn't excitement going on. because they start to think that something's wrong with their world and their relationships because they're not getting the stimulation that lets them know where the edges are. A neurotypical person can find the edges fairly quickly. We take it for granted and don't think too much about it. We know where we stand based on a variety of subtle cues, and we can sort those things because the machinery in the brain that sorts one thing from another indicates to us which things are important and worth paying attention to and which things are not. And people like con artists who manipulate neurotypical people know how to play on that, which is how the con game works. There's a whole set of techniques for conning borderlines, but they are in fact different than the techniques for conning normal people, and those are the kinds of techniques that I was talking about in the brainwashing episode and that are outlined in the book The Wrong Way Home. Basically anything that works on a teenager works on a borderline, because what a borderline experiences day to day as an adult is about the same as a teenager's day-to-day experiences during the most intense parts of puberty, which is the reason that you can't diagnose borderline personality disorder until the late teens. So, Nicole, I'm sorry for the long discursion, but I wanted to make sure we brought everybody else in on the conversation and also to give you an idea of what my command of the subject is so that you will be able to adduce how reliable you think my advice is. Your description of borderline as a roller coaster relative to the neurotypical experience is very, very accurate. The neurotypical experience is not flat. It's just calmer. Think of it, here's a good example. If you ever saw Dick Tracy, the Warren Beatty version in the early 90s. Fun film, really big blockbuster at its time, not entirely successful in terms of being a great movie, but it's totally watchable and is definitely worth checking out for this reason. Dick Tracy is done in primary colors. All of it's done in primary colors. Every last bit. There's only one shade of red and one shade of green and one shade of blue, and it's all bright and brash, and it gives this bursting, vibrant look to the world. Compare that to the kind of photography you would see in your typical Steven Spielberg movie. Not Schindler's List or Saving Private Ryan, where they've overprocessed the footage for an effect, but something like E.T., right? Just your basic bog-standard color film that hasn't been tweaked out. That's a visual metaphor that tracks fairly closely for the difference between the way a borderline will experience emotions, that being those bright primary colors, and the way that a neurotypical will experience emotions, that being the more muted shades of different colors and the blending of different things. Learning to go from the subtle to the brash to write a borderline character as a neurotypical, that I know how to do. Going from the brash to the subtle, that's got to be a little more difficult. Or at least the methodology might not be the same. And so I'm not quite sure how to advise you. Perhaps a set of training wheels would be a good way to start. When you're doing characterization, try perhaps borrowing a page from Sherlock Holmes. I don't mean the recent films with Benedict Cumberbatch. In fact, there's a really great article I just read about this, a great article about the nature and different expressions of empathy that I'm going to put in the show notes to this podcast, because it actually hits a lot of points that you're looking for really well. And I think of it because they use Sherlock Holmes as an example as well. What you're wanting to do is engage your cognitive empathy at the expense of your hot empathy. That automatic amygdala intuitive response that you have to social situations and cues and whatnot is one of two kinds of empathy that humans have. The other is called cognitive empathy, and that's where you understand another person from the inside out by imagining the entirety of their circumstances and conditions and taking your own needs for importance or your own worldview out of the picture. There's a set of tools that we all have to do that come sort of with the package of being human. They are attenuated in borderlines in the same way hot empathy is attenuated in psychopaths. But as with psychopaths, most borderlines are moderate to low level borderlines, and they have access to most of the tools. It's just that they don't use them automatically. High level borderlines, to the point where it makes your life kind of unglued constantly, this might be a little more difficult if you are way high up the scale. But it might be worth practicing anyway. You want to be using your cognitive empathy to sort of run a simulation for what life would look like from this other set of circumstances, and react through those characters not on the basis of your hot intuition, but on the basis of a little more cool reasoning. It's possible, if you're like many borderlines I've worked with or known, it's possible that you have one or two areas of your life where everything is kind of cool and calm, and you can sort of pretend to be Spock with things. That's the toolkit that you want to be using, and using that simulation hardware to reason your way through responses when your sense of existential danger or engagement is taken out of the picture. Because the thing that gets triggered when you're looking at things through your amygdala is your existential importance. When things come through your amygdala, they are striking your nervous system as either threats to your life and well-being or salvation for your life and well-being. There are other things you run into, at least sometimes, that don't strike you that way and that you react to on a different basis. Those other things are engaging your prefrontal cortex and your orbital cortex instead of your amygdala, or at least in advance of your amygdala. So if you can get a toehold into those processes in your own mind and turn those towards imagining what it would be like to be someone who relies a lot more on those processes than on their amygdala, you'll probably begin to develop something that works for you. The way that neurotypicals experience the world is mediated about half the time through cognition as opposed to amygdala. And it's not a binary either-or thing. It's more of a blending. Be the difference between a milk chocolate and a chocolate vanilla swirl. Because you experience life in brash colors, when two colors mix, they don't blend, they just mix together. With a neurotypical, when they mix, they'll actually bleed into one another and make a third thing as well. Anyway, I'm having a lot of fun with this, but I don't know how useful I'm being, so I'm going to cut it off here, and feel free to send in a follow-up or two if anything I've said seems useful to you at all. Thanks a lot for taking the flyer. This is a hell of an interesting topic, and it's very complex to explore, and I love chewy questions like that, so thanks for sending it in. I hope that helps, and I'll see you all tomorrow. The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions. Visit our website at everydaynovelist.com and leave a tip in the tip jar or join the Patreon to support this podcast. The Everyday Novelist is copyright 2017 J. Daniel Sawyer and Artistic Whispers Productions, Inc. and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License.